This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Later in the show today, we'll learn about a startup company hoping to harness the collective knowledge and passion of true crime fans around the country to solve cold cases. But first, human remains that could be over 2,000 years old were discovered in Columbus. We're talking to one of the people analyzing those remains to find out more. We're joined now by Christopher Schmidt, professor of anthropology at the University of Indianapolis. Welcome to the program, Christopher. Let's start with these remains. Where and how were they discovered?
So these were accidentally hit through construction. There's some building going on in Columbus, and excavators there were doing their work. They astutely noticed that there were some human remains. Following the law, they contacted Indiana DNR. They sent out their expert, and she was able to determine, yes, these are, in fact, human remains. Then they contacted tribal entities and to see if they felt that an excavation was appropriate. And after consideration, they decided, yes, these are, you know, going to be impacted. They should be moved. And so then I was contacted at University of Indianapolis, and we've been here since trying to recover and then eventually analyze the remains that have been hit.
Mm-hmm. So you're on site right now?
I actually am on site right now, and it's raining down here. So my apologies if it's
okay.
You hear that. But it's I'm on site today.
Oh, that's really cool that you're actually there and you're seeing all of this go down. So what are the remains exactly? When you say that remains were discovered, is it, you know, a bone, a tooth? Like, what would it be?
Correct. So these are skeletal remains. They are most likely in the order of a few thousand years old. So they are completely skeletonized. And these are not intact burials. They have been hit by construction practices, actually probably on multiple occasions. And so they're not just in a position like they would be anatomically. We're having to find elements kind of moved around in the sediment. So that's been our challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say that might be so complicated just to find all the little pieces and be able to put them together. And do you do anything like with technology to be able to get the bigger picture?
Actually, it doesn't really require much in the way of technology. Really, what we're doing is using our expertise as osteologists. When I say we, I've got a team out there of UND graduate students, undergraduate students, and then two or three students, or they're actually former students. They have their master's degrees. They're getting ready to go on for their PhDs, and they're working in the field too. So you take all this expertise, and you go through the sediments, you find the materials. Then when we bring it back to the lab, it's simply trying to figure out what bones do you think match up by individual, what bones do you think match up by individual bones. If you have a fragment here and a fragment here, we'll try to see if they fit together. And that's how we'll eventually figure out about how many people were originally interred at this particular site.
Mm. And so When you say these remains may be thousands of or 2,000 years old, I guess what I'm wondering is how are they able to stay discoverable for that many years?
Yes. So bones are mostly rock. They're mostly mineral already. So in that way, they're very fossil-like. And so natural bone can preserve for millions of years, provided the soil is not acidic. If it's an acidic soil, they will not last very long. But even here in Indiana, they weren't human bones, but natural animal bones in the order of a few million years old were found in northern Indiana several years ago. So it's possible to find human remains that are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12,000 years old in this part of the world. That is plausible.
Wow. And were you surprised with this particular discovery? Did anybody know that there would be anything in that area?
Well, you know, that's such an awesome question. And even this idea of discovery is sort of an interesting concept, because when we think about the history of Indiana, it's a 12,000 year history. And most of that history comes from people before, you know, Europeans and folks of African descent and Asian descent settled here. So it's in some ways, it's not a surprise at all, because most of our history really is a Native American history. And so in that regard, no, there's lots of evidence of what we call pre-contact folks in Indiana. Now, did we expect it to be exactly in that one spot where a building was going up? No, I think it's fair to say. I don't think anyone expected that. But it's really not a surprise to find evidence like this of folks who lived here for so long.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that some of the tribal communities were informed of this. Is this common practice when really ancient remains are found?
Yes, it is. Well, it's becoming more common practice. So in the past, in involvement with Native American groups in accidental discoveries like this, of course, they always followed local laws and Indiana laws. But we weren't, as an archaeology community, we weren't doing a good enough job of starting with the Native American community. And so that is changing, and that has changed for this particular project. So it's actually very exciting to be working with folks from the get-go and to have involvement right off the bat and consultation. So that will also make the ongoing process that much better. We're already into discussions about repatriation. In other words, figuring out where these remains will go after they're studied. So it's actually been a great experience working with tribal entities.
Mm-hmm. And so what prompted that change to be more involved with tribal communities?
I think awareness. I think that archaeology, like a lot of parts of society, I don't think we were aware enough of Native voices. You know, Native Americans a lot of times are treated as something of the past, but, you know, Native American communities are here now, living folks. And I think it's important for us to make sure that all voices are being heard. And we hear this in lots of different avenues of society. And archaeology, I think, is one of those places that needed to wake up. And I think that we are trying to be more engaged from the onset rather than sort of catching up. And it really has been a very, a much better experience. And I think it makes archaeology even that much more relevant, because even like that word discovery, I've been thinking about that a lot. And to me, really, these aren't discoveries so much as really more of a discussion, because the people we're meeting, you know, it's hard to discover people. You know, they're there, but this awesome discussion that you get to be a part of, one, with living Native Americans, but two, the information you get from the people of the past. You get to have this very cool discussion. It's an honor to learn this material. So that's really, I think, part of that change in our viewpoint. And like I said, I really think it's benefited our discipline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can imagine it must be really remarkable for the Native American community to be able to have access to some of their history. So with these remains, what is the process like? So you're going to put them together and try to figure out what they are exactly. What does that work entail?
So that work will be conducted at University of Indianapolis. And what that entails is bringing back all of the fragments. And there are many, many fragments. And we'll take all the fragments that we think represent single individuals and put them together. We're not like, it doesn't get rebuilt like something you'd see on a TV show. It's you know, we're not going to be gluing bones and stuff like that back together. But we do put them in their anatomical positions, and we do try to figure out how old people are, what their sexes are. To confirm the ancestry, it is important for us at this site to recognize that, you know, we've got to make sure that everyone represented here is from the time period we think they're from, and that is, we think that they are Native American. And then we'll also look for evidence of diseases and any other sort of phenomena that sort of help us understand people from what we call this biocultural approach, meaning we're trying to understand that intersection of our biology, meaning the skeleton, but also the cultural things like what we eat that affect that skeleton. And so we'll do that sort of analysis as well. And that'll take several weeks, by the way. This will take a while. And then, like I said, we'll work with the tribal entities, and they will help us coordinate a way to have all the remains repatriated. And all these remains will be repatriated.
Mm-hmm. So fascinating that you're able to find out all of these things just by analyzing remains. As we get ready to wrap up here, I don't know if this is even a relevant question, but can you take like the DNA from any of these remains to analyze, or is it just too old?
No, that's a great question. It is absolutely possible to take DNA from these remains, but we don't do any analysis that's destructive. And so in this case, to take a DNA sample would be destructive. And again, in consultation with Native communities, there's no destructive analysis. So we won't be taking any DNA samples from any of these individuals. But DNA, just to address the question more broadly, can be taken from human remains that are many, many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years old, provided, you know, a few environmental things, you know, it can degrade in certain environments, but it can survive for quite some time.
Mm, fascinating. Well, what's next for this project? You said it might take several weeks to get some things put together. Do you have any sense of what you're looking at all?
Yes. So in terms of field work, we don't know exactly how much longer that's going to take, but we think we're in the orders of days and weeks rather than months. In terms of the analysis, we're looking at a few months. And in terms of where we think we're going with the analysis, our current hypothesis, of course, is that all the remains are Native American. We do suspect, based on a few anatomical features, that these folks are probably in that 2,000 to 3,000 year range. But I should emphasize, that's just a hypothesis. That's just something we're going with right now, and then we'll kind of address it. There are certain things on the teeth, for example, that make us think, oh yeah, these people lived like 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, or this group lived just 1,000 years ago. So I think these groups right now, we think is 2,000 or 3,000, and we'll keep exploring from there.
Well, thank you so much, Christopher Schmidt, professor of anthropology at the University of Indianapolis. We'll be back after a quick break to talk about a startup company from people in Indianapolis that aims to turn true crime fans into a nationwide network that can help investigate unsolved cases. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. True crime has been an incredibly popular genre for years, from podcasts to TV shows, books, and documentaries detailing real crimes, often unsolved crimes. It's proven to be addictive entertainment for millions of people. But the crimes in true crimes are, as it says right in the name, true. Well, a group of tech industry veterans from Indiana have started a company that attempts to use the national network of people interested in true crime to actually work on investigating unsolved crimes. With us now are three of the co-founders of that company, Ashley Fujawa, Anna Elin, and Jim Brown. Thank you all for joining us today. I'm going to start with you, Ashley. How did you get into true crime?
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much for having us. For me, it's something that I was always fascinated by younger growing up. I remember distinctly a case when I was around 11 years old in southern Indiana, the Shanda Share case, that was the first time that a story turned into more than just something that was scary that I saw on television, but was an actual person and not too far from my hometown and not too far from my age as well. And then from that, just always being interested in fascinating and kind of following stories, following cases. And then Anna and I actually met when we were in college, and we had this shared fascination and interest, and we're just kind of informing each other along the way.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, how did you get involved in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, Ashley's definitely right. So we met in college, and, you know, we both kind of shared this interest in the space and true crime. So for me, in 2004, my cousin went missing here in Indianapolis, Molly DeTillo. It's still actually an unsolved case. So that's something that, you know, as someone who's interested in this space and this genre, I kind of got to see another side of it. I got to see the, you know, what it actually means to have someone missing who isn't coming home and you don't have answers. So that always kind of tinted my view of this genre, especially as a genre for entertainment. And then, you know, I was lucky enough to get to work with Jim Brown, who is a very accomplished, you know, person here in the Indianapolis tech scene. And, you know, he basically was like, hey, I've got this great idea. I want to do something that matters. I want to do something, you know, in this space. And so, you know, that's really all he had to tell me. And I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm. And so, Jim, I'm going to ask you also the similar question of how you got involved in this space.
Yeah, there's always a case that brings people in. For mine, it was the Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman case. You know, a lot of people unfortunately know that as the O.J. Simpson trial. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do with our product is bring the voice back to the victims, because they're the ones that actually matter. It's not the other side. But for me and for most of America, that was the first case that was nationally broadcast. The entire trial was on display. And so you could really dig in and understand what was going on. And at that point, I was just hooked and I was fascinated and I wanted to see how we could affect the criminal justice system and then solve these cases for the murdered or missing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point that you made, bringing back the voice for the victims. Well, I do want to ask about this entertainment aspect, Ashley and Anna and Jim, all of you. Either of you can answer this. The entertainment genre that has become true crime, how does that impact getting cases solved? Is it turning it more into this entertainment entity where we're just going to forget about the cases? It's just a great binge on Netflix versus someone actually solving it. I don't know, Ashley, if you want to take that.
Yeah. So we know that there are tons of people interested in this space. And for the most part, it has been focused on entertainment and consumption. But what we are creating is an opportunity to turn people not just from interest and consumption, but to advocacy. So utilizing that power of collective impact and that power of joint interest in a subject and providing people a location to learn more about a case that they're interested in or following. So if, you know, you listen to something, particularly in true crime, you're probably listening to half a dozen other things. And once you hear someone on a podcast tell you a story or you watch a documentary, you're probably heading right to the internet to find a map or a photo or digging in for more information. So we're utilizing that opportunity to bring people into a platform and organizing the data in a way that it's never been done before by creating public timelines and connecting those with photos, with maps, and then crowdsourcing a community who's already interested in consuming this information into filling in those gaps and providing them distinct calls to action to do more and to utilize their personal agency and platform to share stories that people don't often hear about and don't get proper representation in the media, the community, or the justice system, or confirm information or find more information in these areas for some of these cases that have gone, you know, 20, 30 years without any more information.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if is part of the reason these cases go unsolved, lack of resources, and is this platform you're creating going to enable, I guess, more people to get involved, Anna?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, it's definitely a lack of resources across the board. You know, there's, you know, the numbers of unsolved cases are absolutely growing and less are being solved every year. And so what we believe our true hypothesis is, if we can bring all this information together, because a lot of this information, we're only dealing in publicly available information. It's all out there. But what we're doing is we're bringing it all together, like Ashley said, and we're organizing it in a way we can help people really understand the case, understand exactly what needs to happen. What are the key things that we need to know about this case? How can we put together the timeline in a way that people can really understand it and then insert themselves? I mean, we see cold cases solved every day by just someone saying, hey, this reminds me of something else. Like, sometimes it's that easy. Sometimes we think we'll never be able to figure out what happened, but it's just a matter of bringing people who have shown that they have an interest in this space, pulling them in and saying, here's something you could definitely do to help. And then seeing what happens from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, what is it about true crime that appeals to people? Why has this become so popular?
I think it's a fascination that we all have to just understand what happened, to solve, ironically, like puzzles and mysteries and things like that. We want to lean into the unknown. I think that's part of the fascination. But I want to hit on that point that you asked, Anna, as well, as like, is there a lack of resources around law enforcement? And the answer mm-hmm. to that is yes. We've done the research to know that only 10% of all law enforcement agencies across the country have dedicated cold case investigators. 10%. Only 7% actually have a formal cold case unit. And these numbers are alarming, right? That's the reason why more than 5,000 cases per year are going unsolved. And then we start talking about that fascination of this from an entertainment genre. when we did market research there, we found 86% of all Americans are interested in true crime content. Like that's an amazing, astonishing number. But then we went a little bit further. 64% of those people had interest in learning more about the case beyond the podcast or the documentary or however they consumed that content. But then even further, 34% of those people wanted to do more. They wanted to get involved, but didn't know how. And so our goal with Uncovered is to give them that next step. Here's what you can do on this case to help us bridge the gaps.
Mm-hmm. And Ashley, when we talk about the site that you started, Uncovered, where did the name and the idea come from? I know you guys all talk together, but where did this sprout from?
Again, it was that shared interest in cases. And like Jim had mentioned, solving a puzzle and uncovering more, wanting to dive in deeper. I'm a former school teacher, so I know people consume information in different ways. So bringing in that opportunity for people to educate themselves. Digital literacy is very important for us as we're introducing new cases to people and cases that they've heard about, but also showing them how to do a proper Google search to find more information, how to verify information, how to follow accurate sources, how to utilize their skills in organization and research. It's really interesting, Miriam. We have a community that we've been able to layer on who are dedicated to utilizing those skills and to finding more information in cases and keeping them public. That's really important, particularly for the family members and the family advocates we work with, that just other people hear these cases and talk about them and continue to talk about them and keep them in front of people.
Well, for our listeners, if you have any questions or comments for the program today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Now, Anna, with this project, was it hard to get this off the ground, or did it come together pretty quickly?
Ooh, that's a great question. I would say maybe a little bit of both. I think we always knew we wanted to do something in this space. I think we all agree that there's something that needs to be done here. There's some need to turn people's interest into advocacy, and that's something we've always wanted to do. So figuring out how to go about doing that, I think, was we weren't quite sure what that looked like at first, but we were lucky enough to ship an MVP last year. We got that out into the world. And that was really the database of breaking down cases. And so now we've got about 75 cases on our site. We are working really hard to kind of get our technology infrastructure upgraded so we can do more and more and more. So what's really important to us now is getting people there, getting people to the site, giving us feedback, what's working, what's not working. So we're really excited with what we have out, but we have grand, ambitious plans to really expand and do more.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, I know you launched a crowdfund campaign to raise, I think it was $125,000 for this project. Were you able to get the funding you needed?
We were. We surpassed it. We're about 106% of that. And one of the cool things about the Indiegogo platform is once you've hit your goal, they leave it open in what's called an in-demand status. So we've actually been still receiving more contributions since hitting the goal. So we're very excited about the community support that we've seen there.
Mm-hmm. And what made you go the crowdfunding route to get this off the ground?
Well, we had a hypothesis that the community that there is a community out there that wants something like this. And so we kind of proved that. But then we also wanted to make sure that they would help us and support us with not only their time, but also their dollars. And so I think that the notion of being able to raise $125,000 through those means also justified that. But I say all that because this is a business. And one of the questions we get quite a bit is, you know, why does this cost money and why isn't this a not-for-profit? And while very good questions, right, like, we believe that we can use technology for good. And while not-for-profits have a great place in our society, while government entities have a great place in our society, corporations also need to do public good as well. So we organize as a public benefit corporation. And so getting the public to actually support this mission was very important for us.
Mm-hmm. So to clarify, this is not a nonprofit.
It is not a not-for-profit. It is a for-profit public benefit corporation. And so just to kind of decipher between what the two of those are, with a traditional C corporation, if you will, right, their number one stakeholder is shareholder return, shareholder value. With a mm-hmm. public benefit corporation, the number one stakeholder is the public. What public impact are you providing? And so when we wrote up our articles of incorporation and our mission statement, we have metrics that we're graded on. And our four things that we are focused on are bringing peace to the families of murdered or missing people, reducing the burden on law enforcement, helping influence public policy in support of equality in criminal justice reform, and then ultimately helping overturn wrongful convictions. So as we make decisions, those are our guiding metrics. We need money to sustain the business and hire the best talent and brains in technology and marketing and infrastructure and all that kind of stuff. But we always lean back to those four main pillars of our organization.
Mm-hmm. And how does this differ, for example, Ashley, like when I was growing up, I think there was Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted, and they would have like phone numbers you could call. How is this different from that sort of call out for public help?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite similar that we continuously see law enforcement agencies asking someone if you've seen something, report it. Many times it is a phone number, but, you know, as technology progresses, people aren't, you know, picking up the phone anymore. So we're bringing it to a platform and we're bringing it to a space where people are already having these conversations and already kind of using their skills and kind of leaning into that puzzle solving and putting it in front of people and making it easy for them to act on that. So we see all the time, hey, you know, confirm this information or share this from a case that's solved across the country. We're making that easier and easier for people to do, particularly visualizing those timelines and those cases so people can see the dots that need to be connected.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is you look at cases all across the country. With your team right now, how are you able to balance all of that? I'm just curious, like what everybody's role is, Anna, like what do you take care of within the organization?
Yeah. So for me, I'm really overseeing the technology piece of what we're doing. So how are we building? What does our infrastructure look like? How are we continuing to grow? We're doing a lot of manual work to get these cases up on our site. A lot of research is going in. We're putting them, you know, pretty much manually into our database. And our goal is to kind of grow to a more automated place where we can use AI machine learning to really scrape these cases and pull more information in so we can have more and more and more data there. So for me, I'm really concerned with, you know, how we can grow our technology stack in a really scalable way.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Jim?
Yeah, so my role is really twofold. My kind of day job is to liaison with law enforcement. That is one of the things that we want to be able to do, understanding how do we not interrupt the investigation format, but also still be able to be called and call our community onto action with them. Another part of that is fundraising, right? So again, we have to have money to build the tools and technology that we want to do. So that's what I'm spending the majority of my days doing.
Mm-hmm. And Ashley?
So I'm working with our community. So not only are our citizen detectives and citizen solvers and researchers, but the content creators who are out there who are, you know, creating these podcasts and doing this research. And then even our universities, we're actually partnering with Purdue University currently on some curriculum development within the forensics department. So finding all of those great opportunities to connect different audiences and different groups together for one mission.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the data that you're using, Jim, where does the data come from? I know I heard you mentioning, I think, Anna, about using AI or scraping some sources. But where else do you get the data?
Yeah, so our very first data set is publicly available information. So one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to build systems that we can go out and scrape all publicly available, reputable sources. So whether this be NPR like yourself, whether it be the different news outlets, but then we get into blogs and whatnot. But we're trying to go gather everything that's already out there publicly, and that'll be our first data set. And then eventually we do want to expand. We are starting to have families reach out to us and say, hey, this is what has been needed for so long. Can you help us? And when that happens, the family will actually provide us information that's not publicly available. And that's where we'll start to have different firewalls, if you will, of access of information, because we can't let everything get out into the public domain. But with publicly available, it'll remain publicly available. But then we also want to be able to continue working with law enforcement. And there are some things that law enforcement can release from their files to say, hey, there's this yellow car that was seen. Here's the make and model. Like, does anybody know? Did they see this? Something along those lines. So those are the three levels of data that we're looking at. And then, as Anna was talking about, we want to provide or build AI and machine learning systems that can say, okay, we have this large data set now. Where are the gaps? And what is the piece of information that if we get could crack the entire case wide open?
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to cracking the case, who's the one that will be finding the results and cracking the case, so to speak? Would that be you and your team? Or is this the public?
So we are very intentional about the words that we use. And so it is our mission to bring peace to the families. And the reason why we use that word is because we want to let families know what happened. That's the only thing that we truly can do. We cannot guarantee that we can bring justice to these. That is law enforcement's responsibility. So we will work with the families to help figure out what happened, but then we have to turn over all information and then work with law enforcement to get that pushed through into the criminal justice system and hopefully bring justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely want to talk a little bit more about law enforcement and how they're working with you on this project, but we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back. We're talking with the co-founders of a company that hopes to use true crime audiences to actually help investigate and solve unsolved crimes. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. You can send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it on the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on a company started by a group of Indiana Tech veterans that aims to use an online network of true crime fans to help investigate unsolved cases. With us are the three co-founders of the startup company Uncovered.com, Ashley Fujawa, Anna Eaglin, and Jim Brown. Before the break, we touched upon sort of law enforcement's role in all of this. And I'm curious, Anna, what was law enforcement's response? Have you had any contact with them about this project?
So, yeah, so we've definitely spent some time with some law enforcement officials. And a lot of what we hear is, you know, a lot of these case files sit, you know, in binders and they're paper based and they haven't been touched. I think, you know, law enforcement, again, is so overwhelmed with the work that they need to do. And we know there's just not enough resources to put toward these cold cases. So we know that there's an opportunity here. Again, we always hear law enforcement officers say, we hear departments say, you know, we could use your help with this. You know, if you see something, say something. And so we really believe that there's a great opportunity for us to partner and work together.
And Jim, what's that been like so far? Have you worked on anything?
We have. It's been all across the board. As you can imagine, there's a spectrum of law enforcement agencies, and some going more traditional, conservative in their approach and old school methodologies to more progressive, those leaning into the internet and the public being helpful. So a couple examples. We have worked to talk to First Sergeant Bill Dalton with the Indiana State Police. There's a 40-year-old still cold case with the Burger Chef murders. Four teenagers were murdered after their shift over in Speedway, Indiana. As I sat in his office, he pointed behind his desk and literally to six different 4-inch thick binders and said, Jim, that's the case right there. Right? 40 years. It's like paper. It's handwritten notes. It's like mentions of just first names. Like, how do you do anything with that? And so as we started to explain to him what we're doing, he's like, look, if you could just get all of that digital by itself, that's a huge win. But then, as Anna has talked about with the product that we're developing, if you can then start to lay that out on a map and then put that into a timeline of events and be able to click and drag and move everything around, that's amazing. And then if you can start to index who the people are, how they're connected, and be able to show profiles of them, like, this would change the game for us. We've worked with Detective Mickey Hamilton in Washington State of, I think it was a 10-year-old cold case, maybe 10 or 15-year-old, of the disappearance of Nancy Moyer. And in fact, I'm not going to say that case is solved, but citizen detectives helped break that case. So there was actually a confession. The next day, the gentleman who did it turned around and recanted his confession. But the details that he gave were enough to know that we're going to head down the right path. But then there's the opposite of that. There's a case that we're working on in Baltimore, Maryland, Baltimore County, Maryland, where the detective there of 20 years, this case, has no interest at all in working with the family, working with us, working with the public. There have been other organizations that have tried to give money for DNA testing, and they just absolutely slammed the door in our face. So different responses from different agencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that this could be because it's new and different, some folks, it's going to be hard to get them on board just yet. But I wonder, Ashley, are you hearing from anyone that's just a little bit nervous about having their information out there? You know, somehow they were part of a case, maybe they were a witness, and they just don't want their name out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real possibility, particularly when you're dealing with cases.
in communities where there's no oversight or there's no shared vision or mission of what you're working on. That's why, again, we work in all publicly available information that has been put out in one form or another. We're just organizing in a way for people to understand better. But that's where it's also critical for us to be able to work with institutions like Purdue and doing trainings with the National Freedom of Information Coalition. And again, showing people how to properly do this and have access to experts and what is actually needed and what can be helpful in these instances.
Mm-hmm. And actually, has anything like this website existed before, or is this something brand new?
No, this is brand new. I mean, there are different databases in different communities, particularly with the Trans Stowe Project or Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. But there's no one centralized database that spans across the country that looks at all of the unsolved cases of the murdered and missing. And not in a way that connects the information that makes it consumable for people as far as anything more than just a photo or a few data points. This is all of the information in one spot, and it's continuously being updated as more information comes in. And then layering on that activated community is crucial here to get people to have conversations and to talk about what's needed in these communities, not just for how to solve a case, but how we can be more empathetic. So these aren't just stories. And it's not just a genre that I'm interested in, but it's how as a community we can lift each other up and help.
And Anna, is there any plans like, so you're based with your team right now, are you going to expand to other parts of the country, or is this just in one location and you're going to take things, I guess, digitally?
Yeah. I mean, so our team is, we're totally remote team right now, even though Ashley and I live in the same city, we still mostly work remote. So we're planning to stay that way. We think the best way to kind of recruit and hire and get the best people is to stay remote. As far as where our cases are located, a lot of our cases come from submissions. People come to our site, they submit a case they care about, either they're connected to it or they're not. Sometimes we have a lot of people who follow cases they have no, connection to, they might have a geographical connection to. But we're looking to really expand. We want to have cases all over the United States. We want to expand into other countries. So really for us, it's just a matter of, again, building that infrastructure to make sure we can support that information. But what we really value is when people come to us and say, hey, here's this case I really, really care about. And that's where we get a lot of the cases that we have on the site right now.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Jim, I'm wondering, with using sources from online and culling through all of that, there's bound to be some misinformation or things that aren't accurate. How do you decipher that and find out what's worth keeping and what you throw out?
That's a fantastic question. And what's ironic for us is, there's been a lot of media coverage of us as we've kind of gotten this off the ground, which we're extremely grateful for. But the misinformation about our project and the things that we've been saying, that alone is crazy. So to think that that's not happening with these cold cases, it just would be absurd. So yes, there is misinformation out there. And so this is where artificial intelligence, machine learning starts to come into play as well. So we're actually creating algorithms to understand what sources of information are the most reputable. Doesn't mean they're perfect. It just means that we know more often than not it's going to be reputable. And that can be websites, that can be people, that can be law enforcement agencies, all of that kind of stuff. So that's one thing, creating an algorithm for reputation. But then also we can start to see how do I want to say this? The community almost, I don't want to say voting because that's not the right word, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. But the community is going to be able to say the fact checking for us and say, no, I've run this down. Here is a different source that actually points to what we believe is the correct information. We don't take that on its head. We have a verification and substantiation process that, again, we run through multiple systems of fact checking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder, too, someone is accused of something or put out there and it's not accurate, how would you deal with something like that?
Yeah. So the one thing we will not tolerate in our community at all is the idea of doxing innocent people. So there's no mentions of any names allowed on the platform unless it has actually been put out there by law enforcement into the public domain. So, we are on that on a regular basis, seeing if there's a name mentioned, it's immediately stripped from the search again, unless it's been verified by law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, talking about these algorithms and these different tools that you're going to be using, how does machine learning and AI factor into all of this?
Yeah, so we really see that kind of being the future of the data that we're pulling together. So one thing that we do understand, though, is that technology is not a neutral thing. So we understand that when we build these algorithms, we put in this machine learning, we want to do it in a very thoughtful and ethical way. Because there's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of issues that have come out definitely in the last couple of years about these algorithms that are just kind of trained on biased data. And so we're really being extremely thoughtful about how we apply this type of technology. So for us, what we see the AI and machine learning, again, kind of what like Jim said, is pulling together connections that people haven't been able to make before. So, you know, there's a lot of data about missing persons, cold cases out there. But what we want to do is pull in even more information, not just where did the crime take place, but what were the multiple locations of the crime, not just the person that was the victim of the crime, but who are their associates? Who are they with? Who is their family? If we can bring in all that different data together and we can tie it, and we can, again, run these algorithms to say, you know, I'm seeing a connection here I've never been able to see before, or I'm seeing, you know, I'm looking at this location and I'm seeing a, you know, a murder case and a missing case. And these have a lot stronger connections than any human would be able to see and compute. So we really do think that there is a great opportunity to apply these techniques to just see data in a way it's never been seen before. And we're really excited to get to the point we can start doing that.
Mm-hmm. It sounds a bit like a mix of data journalism and some detective work here.
I think data journalism is such a great analogy, definitely, for what we're doing. And, you know, and I think journalism isn't too, because a lot of times when we think about these big ethical questions, we look to data journalism and we look to journalism in general, because a lot of these ethics about, you talked about naming people, about doxing, we look to the people who have come before us to say, you know, what's the right path here? We definitely believe that we are doing something brand new, but we think that there's a lot of great frameworks that we can utilize that have already been established.
Mm-hmm. And Ashley, when we're talking about these cases that go unsolved, just for listeners and for myself to understand a little bit more, a cold case, is it generally they've given up and it's closed, or it's just sitting there?
Most of the time it's sitting there. So for our reference, what we utilize on our site and within our community is a case that it's at least 36 months old that hasn't had any substantial movement. That means very different across the country. And as you can imagine, different law enforcement agencies have different terms. But that's what we have seen to be just kind of the model and best practices. So we're able, again, to pull in that publicly available information, work with a family advocate or a content creator, but getting that conversation happening again. I appreciate what Christopher said before in the last interview about it's not just a story, but these are discussions that can happen and start to talk about how we can do better and how we can connect and what we know and who we know.
Mm-hmm. And are there certain cases that typically go unsolved? Do you see any trends with which cases become cold cases?
Unfortunately, it's the communities that, again, aren't being properly represented in the media, the justice system, or the community. So, for instance, Indigenous women, they face murder rates that are 10 times the national average, particularly the LGBTQ plus and trans community, or even the Black community are facing incarceration rates and declining murder clearance rates. So here's an opportunity for us to go into a community, into a genre that is already interested in a subject matter and consuming information, but then introducing them into cases that they haven't heard about or victims whose stories need to be told. So whether that is by location, like Anna mentioned, hey, you're listening to a case out of Baltimore County, let's introduce you to three others. And it's probably cases you haven't heard of because they haven't got proper representation. Or here's a case that has, you know, similar background. If you're interested in it and you could use your skills in X, Y, or Z, that would be really mediated here as well.
And Jim, when it comes to some of the obstacles in getting these cases solved, what have you come across so far? What are the biggest things that stand out to you?
Well, right now, I think that there's a social issue or social movement with trust of law enforcement agencies. And so it's the public talking to law enforcement, right? There's distrust there. And so I think that's one of the biggest things is a lot of these communities just don't want to share the information that they have. And so hopefully with our platform, what we're able to do is infiltrate those communities and get the information that is out there. It does exist, and get people to talk. A lot of times people will have information that they think, oh, that's just such a small piece of information. No one needs to know about that. Or they already know about that. I'm not going to be able to provide any help. Those are the things that break the case. And so we want to give people the opportunity to voice that and sometimes need to do it anonymously. It's interesting, you know, you mentioned unsolved mysteries and like the tip lines and phone numbers and all that kind of stuff earlier. Like people don't want to have their voice heard sometimes. And so being able to do it via email or text message or something along that, we want to give people every single means to share the information that they have, because that one tip could break the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of some of these communities, like communities of color, Anna, who have rightfully so had issues with law enforcement, how do you develop rapport with them to get them to open up?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think it's a lot of like, you know, your actions are going to speak louder than your words. And so one thing we really value on our site, when we decide what cases we want to put on the site, you know, of course we have to, because we are doing a lot of this manually today, you know, it takes us time to get things up. So we actually have we've built our own algorithm that surfaces cases that we're going to do in order. And so we score cases, and we prioritize cases where the person is a person of color, again, indigenous, are they LGBTQ+, are they trans, were they a sex worker? Because, you know, God forbid you engage in any kind of survival sex work and then something happens to you, you get zero media coverage. You don't get attention on your case. And so we really are looking for those cases that are just not being covered, that no one seems to want to spend time on, because a lot of times those are the cases that we just need one connection to really make something happen there. So for us, you know, we talk a lot of, it's one thing to talk about this, it's one thing to say you're committed to it, but we want to show it in the actions. We want to show it in the cases that we put on our site. And that's how we really believe we can say, you know, it's one thing to say you're an advocate, but this is how we want to be an advocate, is to really draw people's attention to these cases that need them.
Mm-hmm. We're also being advised by advisors in this area. So one of our advisors is Angel Turner, whose sister was murdered in 1997, Georgia Lee Moses. And she has struggled for a very long time, not only to find peace in this case and to find out exactly what happened, but to get information and to have her story told properly in the media, but information definitely from law enforcement as well. So being able to come alongside her and provide an opportunity that she can own her narrative and own the information that she has out there, but additional training that we're able to provide with people. We're working with a journalist out of Louisville who actually interviewed us and then reached out specifically and said she wanted to provide more. So now we're able to couple that with opportunities with family. When they're on air, you know, they have a 3-minute soundbite to tell a horrific story or instance that happened, and to get that information out, we're able to provide sources and resources to be able to do that. But we're also being led to say, this is how you should talk about this. This is how you should approach. Anna mentioned we have cases submitted. We have so many cases submitted. So being able to organize that information and prioritize is key. But we also want to let family members know that we hear you and we're here to support. So making sure that we're talking in a thoughtful way and communicating and over communicating as much as we can, so we're not a burden in this process, but we're helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about out of time. We have about a minute left. Jim, what's next for the company as you move forward? What are the next phases?
Well, we're finally starting to open up our membership community, so people can now come in. We're starting to do some white glove onboarding to, as both Ashley and Anna have said, teach them how to use the tools that are available to them to help get involved in this. In our research, we learned that the two main things that it takes for someone to want to get involved in a case is obviously knowing the victim, right, or being related to the victim, or second, living in the geographical proximity. So we're looking on ways to bring communities together around the cases that already exist, and then again, exposing those tools to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time and insight into this project. Good luck with everything. Ashley Fujawa, Anna Eaglin, and Jim Brown are co-founders of the startup company Uncovered.com. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And you can always leave us a voicemail through our app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Or leave us a call at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.